From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of all of you, our listeners. We're thankful for you. We appreciate hearing from you. We appreciate all kinds of support from you. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. Well, happy Labor Day as we pause for a long weekend marking the far too soon end of the summer season and the beginning of the dreaded home stretch of the presidential campaign season. We're holding ourselves back from asking guests to take time to be with us so they can take a well-needed rest. Instead, we'll bring you some of our favorite conversation from past shows, harvested from the bulging archives of State of Belief Radio's 10-year history of broadcasting.
I'm Ray Kirstein, producer of State of Belief Radio. It was June of 2013, and Welton and I were making our way through the rolling hills of Morris Plains, New Jersey. We were heading to the home of the retired Episcopal Bishop of Newark, New Jersey, the Right Reverend John Shelby Spong. His wife, Christine, welcomed us warmly and offered a refreshment while we waited for the bishop, then age 82, to complete his morning workout on a treadmill somewhere deep within the house. It's been 3 years since we taped and broadcast that hour-long interview. The topics we covered were wide-ranging, and it was readily apparent why the bishop is both revered and reviled in various Christian circles. Some have called his work nothing short of redemptive, while a leading Southern Baptist academic has been far from alone in labeling him a heretic. Bishop Spong has published an additional book since that summer, extending a writing career that dates back to 1973. His topics have been provocative and profoundly relevant. His books, bestsellers with titles ranging from Rescuing the Bible from Fundamentalism and Why Christianity Must Change or Die, to The Fourth Gospel, Tales of a Jewish Mystic, which had just been published at the time of our interview. Since then, Bishop Spong has added to his body of work with the 2015 release of Biblical Literalism, A Gentile Heresy. Welton's conversation with the bishop about that book is available on our website at stateofbelief.com. But for this Labor Day weekend, we want to take the time to rebroadcast that in-home interview from 3 years ago and hope you'll find it just as valuable as we did, and still do.
Bishop Spong, first of all, let me just say what an honor it is to interview you. You are a person that I've admired and whose writings I have read carefully. And so to interview you is really a special pleasure. You and Christine are so hospitable in asking us to come to your house and hosting us here.
Thank you for doing it.
I want to talk about the book, but I really want to frame it in the context of your ministry. I wonder, when did you begin to realize that you are a clarifier and a dissenter and a reformer for people who have hoped for change in the Christian church but not known whether it would ever come or go far enough? When did you realize that you were crucial to that?
I'm not sure I've ever realized how crucial I am. I think it's a matter of a consciousness emerging in time, and you have simply articulate that consciousness. I grew up in a Christian church, an Episcopal church, as a matter of fact, in Charlotte, North Carolina, that taught me that segregation was the will of God and quoted the Bible to prove it. They taught me that women were inferior to men by nature and quoted the Bible to prove it. They taught me it was okay to hate other religions, and especially the Jews, and quoted the Bible to prove it. And they taught me that homosexuals were either mentally sick or morally depraved, and of course quoted the Bible to prove it. And so my life has sort of been an emergence out of the prejudices that my church planted in me. And they came in various stages. I'd like to think that it was a Damascus Road experience, and I got up and said, now I'm in a different place. But the fact is that racism is in the blood of people that grow up in a segregated South. I still consider myself a recovering racist. And the civil rights movement posed the issues for me very bluntly, and it caused me to look at people very differently. And I can remember the stages. I can remember as a child, I was maybe in the fifth grade, maybe 10 years old, World War II had begun. There's a great rush of patriotism around. And another school in Charlotte invited my school to send some representatives to a, quote, patriotic assembly that they were planning. And for some reason, I don't know why, I was chosen one of three, maybe four, with our teacher. It was a lark for me because I got out of school. And at that point, it never occurred to me that schools were segregated. It didn't occur to me to think there were no black children in my school. That's just the way things were. Segregation builds very high walls. But I got over to the school, and suddenly I saw more black children than I'd ever seen before in my life. And I saw black teachers. The only black people I'd ever seen before had been domestic servants or people working in your yard. And these people were teachers, and the principal was black, and they were driving cars. I'd never seen a black person drive a car. I'd seen a black man drive an old truck. But this was just an eye-opening experience. And then we went into the assembly, and we were honored guests, so we were seated up on the stage, and they said, "Let us now stand and say together the Lord's Prayer." That was quite legal in North Carolina in 1944, or 43, I guess this was. And so we did, and I knew the Lord's Prayer, so I joined right in. And then it suddenly occurred to me that all these people were praying the same prayer to the same God. And we weren't allowed to worship together. I'd never seen a black person in worship with me before. And then they told us to remain standing and say the Pledge of Allegiance. I did that. I was a Cub Scout. I knew how to do that. I was very proud. I put my hand over my heart. And remain standing for the singing of our national anthem. Well, I knew that, too. It's a pretty tough song to sing when you're 10 years old, but I knew it. And I stood up and got ready to sing, "Oh, Say, Can You See?" And that wasn't the national anthem. They played Lift Every Voice and Sing, which I heard later was called the Black National Anthem. And every child in that school knew that by heart and sang it. It was a whole new revelation. And I'd been told that slavery was a really wonderful thing that we white folks had done for those poor Africans. You know, we brought them over here and taught them how to dress and brush their teeth and got them baptized. And we just were wonderful people to have done this. And this song was talking about the lash of the master and bleeding feet as you walk toward both slavery and freedom. There was a whole new image. I didn't know what to do with that except to begin to process it. And so it sort of began to be the processing. I had one other experience as a child. My father had taught me that I always must say sir or ma'am when I address my elders. And I would say, "Yes, sir," "No, no, sir," "Yes, ma'am," "No, ma'am." If I failed to do that, they would say, "Yes, what?" And I would quickly put the ma'am in there for fear of the consequences. But my father had hired two black men to help him build a decorative brick wall in our yard. And I was just a little kid, maybe five, and I was going to help. And in the course of the day, one of the two black men who had white hair and was clearly elderly said something to me, and I responded, "Yes, sir," to him as I had been taught. My father grabbed me, took me into the house and lectured me sternly that you do not say sir to what he didn't, I'm not going to say what he called him.
Yeah.
But again, that's the first time I remember thinking maybe my father's wrong. You know, father, parents are sort of God figures to little children. And yet this didn't add up. I'd been taught to respect my elders. This man was clearly my elder. I'd done what I'd been taught and I was disciplined for it. And that didn't make any sense to me. Nobody told me there's another factor in there called race that didn't fit in. So, you know, that was, again, discomfort. And that's about all I can remember from my childhood. My life was enforced. All my prejudices were enforced with biblical quotations. And the first step I took out of that was when I was about 14. And we had a new rector who had come to our church, and he broke all the molds in my mind. This was right after World War II. He was a Navy chaplain in the South Pacific. He was 32. I really thought you had to be about 80 to be a priest, because I'd never known one that wasn't 80. He drove a Ford convertible. That was just very shocking to me. I thought all clergy drove hearses. I'd never seen a clergyman in anything but a hearse. And he wore white buck shoes, which might not be stylish today. It was pretty stylish in 1946. And he played a guitar, and he sort of reminded me of Bing Crosby and Going My Way, but I hadn't seen Bing Crosby at that point. But this man was very different. In every area, he was different. And he was not a biblical fundamentalist. He was what I call an ecclesiastical fundamentalist. He didn't say the Bible says. He says the church teaches. And But I found out the church has been teaching for 2,000 years, and it's awful hard to track down exactly what they teach on every subject. So you got a lot more flexibility when you say the Bible says. Somebody says, well, show me where it says that, and you have to go to chapter and verse. So that was the first sort of step into flexibility. Then when I got to the University of North Carolina to begin my undergraduate work, everything about modern education came into collision with my fundamentalistic worldview. And you can't be both. You're either going to be religious in the old sense or you're going to be modern, and you can't keep a foot in both camps. And I found that terribly difficult. And one of the people that was most helpful to me was my professor of zoology. His name was Claiborne Jones. And he was an active, practicing lay Christian. And he was a thoroughgoing Darwinian evolutionist. And I'd never seen those two things put together before. So I really wrestled with that man and took a number of courses with him. And I became sort of what I am now. I'm absolutely convinced of the reality of God, the meaning of the holy, the transcendent. I'm not convinced of anybody's definition of that God. And so I see my life as a journey into the mystery of that God. The only path I know how to walk is the Christ path. If I were a Buddhist, I'd walk the Buddhist path, but I'm not a Buddhist. I'm not a Jew. I'm not a Muslim. I don't have any disrespect for these three, but the path I know, the path that's been opened to me to walk, is the Christ path into the mystery of God. So I walk it. I don't believe that God's a Christian. And I think if I walk my path, my Christ path, deeply enough, I'll transcend all the limits of my religion. My hope is that the Jew and the Muslim and the Buddhist and the Hindu will do the same thing as they walk their path into the mystery of God. And that once we transcend the limits of human religion, then maybe we'll be able to share in a way that we can't share now. We don't have to sacrifice anything. I can say to my friends in other faiths, from walking the Christ path, this is the gift that I have received, and I want to share it with you. And they can say, well, this is a gift I've received from walking the Jewish path, the Muslim path, etc., and I want to share it with you. And so we can take on the treasures of the other without anybody having to sacrifice their principles. Now, you put that kind of transition into the same life that's wrestling with the fact that I have four daughters who crashed every boundary that people have placed on women's potential, and that I became a bishop in a metropolitan New York area where I had to engage the gay community, and I began to see humanity in all sorts of forms and any discrimination against any child of God on the basis of any external thing simply becomes a violation of everything that I believe about God and everything I believe about humanity. And I'm the sort of person that I describe myself as having an overdeveloped left brain and an underdeveloped right brain. But once you get through my brain and convert my mind, there's no way I can't act on that new conviction. And so when I became aware, after a lot of study with some doctor friends of mine, that homosexuality is simply one aspect on the spectrum of human sexuality, and that it's neither good nor bad, and it's not chosen. It's simply you awaken to it. I didn't choose to be heterosexual. I just woke up when girls didn't seem obnoxious to me any longer. I didn't make a decision about it. I just sort of followed my glands, I guess. Yes. And so you realize that others don't do that either. And so it makes no sense to discriminate against people because their skin is different from yours, or their gender is different from yours, or their sexual orientation, or their left-handed is different from mine. There are lots of things in the human family that set us apart from one another. And we fear anything that's different. That's one of the basis of our biology. I think we've been taught to fear anything that's different because it's a threat to survival, and survival drives every living thing from a plant to a human being. So the process of seeing humanity as human and to see God in the midst of humanity, which is the center of the Jesus story, just drives you to a set of different conclusions. And so for what it's worth, I've walked through these revolutions, and I think history will record that I've been on the right side of all of them. And the church, by and large, as an institution, has been on the wrong side of every one of them and has had to be dragged screaming and kicking past that boundary. But we do make it. You know, as I look at my church today, North Carolina, where I grew up, has one Episcopal bishop, and he's an African-American elected by the people. That's a long road from arresting people who come to worship in a white church to electing an African-American to be the top of your church's structure. My church has a woman as the presiding bishop. If we had the comparable office to the Archbishop of Canterbury in America, she is a female, and she is a very competent female. My church now has two openly gay bishops, and we've got a number of gay clergy. I had 35 when I retired, perfectly open, and male and female, and living with their partners. In most cases, some were single, but most of them were living with their partners. And there was never any conflict about this. I've watched these revolutions, and I'm really grateful to have had a chance to share in them.
How did you realize that fundamentalism was wrong, but retain a respect for the Bible and a respect for the church?
That's an interesting trick. It's by and large when people are disillusioned by their religious upbringing, they just kick over the traces.
Right.
I guess there's a part of me that still respects the fundamentalism, not the hardcore misunderstanding. But I was a child in a fairly dysfunctional home. My father was an alcoholic, and he died when I was 12. And fundamentalism gave me a sense of security that I didn't have in my family. And so I don't want to disrespect it at this stage in my life. My mother died a fundamentalist. She didn't finish the ninth grade and did not have the intellectual ability to cope with much beyond that. And so I began to see fundamentalism more as a personality style and a cover for insecurity than I do anything else. And so the last thing I want to do is to hate the fundamentalist or even to judge the fundamentalist. But I'm not going to be one. The journey is a pretty profound journey. And I don't want to do anything other than that. I believe that every time a human being tries to define God, that they commit idolatry, because they act as if God can fit into the categories of the human mind. And yet, I'm not going to be godless. That is, I don't know how to be godless. I call myself a God-intoxicated human being. But the form of God is very non-defined. I loved a statement that a retired bishop made to me on one occasion, and I find myself repeating it. He said, "The older I get, the more deeply I believe, but the less beliefs I have." And I think that's sort of where I am today. Yeah. I love going to church. I say the creeds every Sunday. I have no trouble with the creeds. I regard them as a fourth century love song that our ancestors sang to God. It doesn't bother me that they reflect a three-tiered universe that no longer exists in anybody's mind except the most illiterate. But the creeds, to me, are the way we framed our worship song in the 4th century. So I can sing the 4th century song. I don't literalize it. I don't think it's a straitjacket or girdle into which I've got to force my flabby faith. But I think it's a guide along the way. This is how we understood reality. Now, I live in the 21st century. I've got to understand reality in a very different way. And can I make my image of God fit into the reality of my century? I don't see how I could be a Christian. But it's because I fight that battle daily. And
how do you speak of God?
Well, I try not to speak of God as a being. I think that's where we all get in trouble. I don't see God as an external being, supernatural in power, living somewhere above the sky and periodically invading the earth. What I think I can do without being idolatrous is to talk about not God, but my experience of God. Then I'm talking about something that I can relate to. And I have to face the fact that my experience might be delusional. I've been in mental institutions, and I find a lot of delusional talk about God. Mm-hmm. Maybe mine is too, but I don't think so. I believe that I experience God as a source of life, and therefore I have to regard life as holy. And the more deeply and fully I live, the more I think I make God visible. Mm-hmm. I experience God as a source of love, and this is primarily the Jesus story. But if God's a source of love, the only way I can worship God is by loving. And the more deeply and fully I'm able to transcend my limits and love another person, then the more I think God becomes visible. Mm-hmm. And then I borrow a phrase from Paul Tillich, who was my shaping theologian. Dr. Tillich died about 1963, I believe. But Tillich defined God not as a being, but the ground of being.
Right.
And that's a phrase people have a hard time translating. But if God is the ground of being, then the only way I worship God is to become all that I can be. and then to try to build a world where everybody can become all that they can be, because that's the way you reveal the presence of God. Well, that puts every prejudice to rout, it seems to mm-hmm. me. And it's so deeply biblical. When you go back and look at Paul, and when he wrote Galatians, he said, once you get inside the Christ experience, you discover there's no such thing as a Jew or a Gentile or a man or a woman, or bond or free. And I would add to that, gay or straight, Catholic or Protestant, Jew or Muslim, every category you want. There's just a common humanity. Now, how do we enhance that humanity in such a way as to become humane? I think humanism is a religious ideal. I remember being named the Humanist of the Year once in New York by an organization, and my critics wrote and said, well, now I've always believed you weren't a Christian. Now I know you're just a humanist. I think the opposite of being a humanist is to be inhumane. Mm-hmm. I think Christian humanism is a very real possibility. And the fact that at the center of the Christ story, there is the image of God taking on human form would indicate to me there must be something okay about being human. Mm-hmm. And if we can enhance the humanity of people, then I think we're able to transcend all the barriers.
Yeah.
Human beings, as far as I know them, are all survival-oriented, because I think that's what biology is about. I can take a plant from one end of this house to the other end of this house, and the plant will turn to get the sun from the other direction, because survival is written into the heart of life. I can take you into all sorts of places of the world and show you that every living thing is survival oriented, but it's instinctual behavior. But human beings are self-conscious, so it becomes self-conscious adopted behavior. And one of the reasons that human beings fear anybody that's different is that that's a threat to survival. That's why we're xenophobic. It's not because we're evil or because we've fallen into sin from the Garden of Eden. It's because our biology warns us to be aware of anybody that's different. So prejudices come out of that. Sexism comes out of that. Homophobia comes out of that. Tribalism comes out of that. Religion comes out of that. Religious wars come out of that. The terrible things that we human beings do to one another, and we do it all the time, and even we do it in the name of religion, but the terrible things we do are all survival-oriented. Now, if we can project Jesus as the power of God to call us beyond the self-centeredness of being driven by our survival into the capacity to love others as they are, then I think you transform humanity and you call us into a whole new sense of what it means to be human. And I think that's what the kingdom of God is all about.
Is that the gospel?
I think that's exactly what the gospel is.
Yeah.
And I think you see that in every place. One of the things that fascinates me is in Mark, who's the first gospel writer, tells his story. He tells the story of the Christ. There's no birth in Mark, and there's no appearance of the risen Christ in Mark. It's truncated in a lot of ways. But he gets to the point of Jesus' death, and he has him dead and limp and hanging on the cross. And Mark puts a Gentile underneath the cross and lets him do the interpreting. That's fascinating. Mm-hmm. He's an unclean Gentile. He hadn't been circumcised. He doesn't keep the Torah. He doesn't obey kosher dietary laws. He's unclean by every category that Mark, as a Jew, would have recognized. And yet he puts this unclean Gentile, and he says of this dead life, when you can give your life away in love for others, that's what God is. And we translate that, truly this man was the Son of God, as if he had just passed the Council of Nicaea 101's theology. But that's 300 years later. He was saying, we see God when we see a human life that's so full that it isn't driven by its own survival mm-hmm. and can give its life away and even love those who are killing him. That's a really God portrait. Yeah. I think it's a powerful portrait.
You seem so at peace with yourself, so comfortable with your convictions and the statements that you share with us. Has it always been like that, or have there been the real uphill climbs for you?
Of course. If I'm tranquil now, it's a result of mellowness and old age and the fact that I live in the love of my wonderful wife. You know, I've had 16 legitimate death threats that I've had to deal with. I tell people none of them came from an atheist or a Buddhist. They all came from Bible-quoting, true-believing Christians.
Yeah.
Christine and I have been spat upon as we walked into buildings where we were going to make an address. I've been ostracized. I've been officially disassociated with by the bishops of my church in a vote after I ordained an openly gay man. But the magnificent thing about that vote is that it was 78-74 with two abstentions. And you can hardly disassociate yourself from the House of Bishops if the vote is that close. And I was one of the two abstentions because I tell people I didn't know on how to vote on whether I wanted to associate with me or not. But the fact is that after that vote, I addressed the House of Bishops for about 45 minutes and sort of told them how I had come from being an absolutely homophobic, Bible-quoting kid in Charlotte, North Carolina, to the place where I was willing to put my career on the line for the inclusion of gay and lesbian people. And when I finished that talk, at least 12 bishops came up to my desk and said, if I could have heard that before I voted, I would have changed my vote. At that moment, I knew we had a majority on that issue in the House of Bishops, and that was 1989. Mm. That's a long time ago.
That's a long time.
But, you know, it wasn't easy. I remember the night after that vote, and I had two bishops that came out of the closet to me. Both of them were married. And one of them had voted to associate with me, and the other voted to disassociate with me. And I asked the second one why he was so duplicitous. And he said, because I'm scared to death. The only way I know to protect my hidden homosexual self is to oppose homosexuality all the time, publicly, and so I do. I told him that I had no respect for that because he cannot be who he is. That's dishonest. And I've also known in the House of Bishops people who were just terribly homophobic that turned out to be closeted gay people. And I feel sorry for them because homosexuality is sort of strange. You can't hide the fact that you're black or white, and you can't hide the fact that you're male or female, although I suppose some transgender people do that. But it's really easy to hide your sexual orientation inside lots of closets. Mm-hmm. And we've had a lot of priests who are homosexual that had a married cover for that, and we've had a lot of bishops who've had a married cover for that. And one of the things that's happening in our world today is that we're forcing honesty into the public arena because we're accepting people honestly and we don't accept those who are dishonest.
Right.
So that the pressure now is to come out if you're gay, and it's happening in athletes and it's happening in business executives and it's happening all over the world.
Okay.
And it's becoming almost commonplace. For gay people to come out of the closet, and if they'd all come out of the closet, it would be a healthier society. Because then everybody would say, you? But I like you. There's nothing wrong with you. And so our stereotypes would get broken. And they do. One of the things I learned when I was working with my doctor friends at the Cornell Medical Center on this issue was that the number of gay people in the population appears to be pretty stable at all times and all places throughout all countries and all societies. And once you accept the fact that it's just a stable part of who we human beings are, then it's awfully hard to blame dominating mothers or weak fathers or all the other things we used to blame. Because I don't think you can create a homosexual. I don't think you can create one. I don't think you can change one. I was so glad to see Exodus pass out of existence because it was a fraudulent institution.
Yeah.
I don't know any doctor today who thinks that people choose their sexual orientation. Just don't do it.
But Bishop Spong, what is it about sex in the church? I mean, I know that we pay too much attention to Augustine, who seemed as screwed up on it as anybody.
That might not be the right verb to use, but...
well, that's true.
But he certainly did. Well, the church is a funny institution. It probably knows less about sex than it knows about anything. I mean, some of the stuff we've come out with is really absurd. So the church gives you a definition. It says that if you want to be holy, you're a celibate male. That's a strange definition. That violates everything we know about nature and creation.
Mm-hmm.
And it also is pretty obvious that once you repress healthy sexuality, what you get is not no sexuality. You get distorted sexuality.
Right.
So the church has dealt with all sorts of distortions of its premise, including the child abuse thing, which is a clear systemic sickness. You know, we said about women, there's only one ideal woman, and she's a virgin mother. Well, it's really difficult to be a virgin mother, so presumably only one person can pull that off. That means that every other woman has to accept the fact that she's less than ideal.
Mm-hmm.
So we build guilt into the situation. Then we say to women, well, since you can't be ideal, then you take a charge. You either become a virgin and join the nunnery, you become a mother, and that means you can't use any artificial birth control because that would make sex evil. So the prohibition against birth control is in that. And so a homosexual person just doesn't fit into the category, and so we regard that as evil.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's just plain crazy. And one of the things that's happening in our world is that education has gotten down into the ranks. You know, in the Middle Ages, the only people educated were the priests.
Yeah.
Now, universal education, and I think the more we educate people, and that's why the fundamentalists fight so hard to keep evolution out of the public schools, because there's great power in education when people understand what the issues are. And, you know, you don't want to be on the wrong side. I don't debate today with members of the Flat Earth Society. That issue is closed. You know, it's not one that anybody wants to debate. I don't debate about whether homosexuality is evil or good. It's morally neutral.
Yeah.
So is heterosexuality. Can you misuse it? Of course.
Yeah.
And I think part of what the Christian church has got to do is to help people accept what they are and then find a way to live it out with dignity and holiness and integrity,
yeah,
instead of saying, well, you can't be that, because that's unacceptable, yeah, to us.
I want to go back to the question of identity. Who is a Christian?
Well, basically, it would be a follower of Jesus. But let's understand that religion exercises great psychological force in human beings' lives. Every human being I know looks for some kind of security. And one of the places you look for it is in religion. And if religion is going to give you security, then it's got to be the correct religion. That's why the Pope has to be infallible. That's why the Bible has to be inerrant. That's why you have to say, my religion is the only true religion. My church is the only true church. I control the access to God. Nobody comes to the Father but by me. All of those are the arguments that come out of human insecurity. But see, I think the purpose of Christianity, and maybe of all religion, but I can't speak for that, the purpose of Christianity is not to give us security. It's to give us the courage to embrace the radical insecurity of life with integrity and to keep walking forward. And that's very different. I don't want the peace of God that passeth Equanil or Prozac. I want something that gives me the courage to live in a terribly insecure and frantic world and to live with integrity and to recognize that I can't always change it. And the idea that we can somehow change or manage our world with our religion becomes an idolatry. But I don't think that's what the Christian faith is all about. If you look at the Bible, the images of Christianity were never majority images. The idea that we're supposed to set the pattern and rule the world, the images are you're the salt in the soup, you give the soup its flavor, you're the leaven in the loaf, you give the loaf its capacity to rise, you're the light in the darkness. To watch the Roman Catholic Church and women go at it over health care is an interesting thing, because it's good to be Roman Catholic. It's good to be women. You've got two good things colliding, but they're colliding because they've got a different understanding of what their responsibility is. I would never want a Roman Catholic to violate their conscience. I would also never want them to impose their understanding of reality on the body politic. That's what the separation of church and state is all about, and wars have been fought over those issues. And if you're going to be a part of this society, you have to live with some compromises. That's just the way life goes.
And isn't that a basic principle to be recognized by those who seem to want to use political power as a tool to leverage a kind of what they see as a Christian nation?
If you look at American history, what we have going on today in the Tea Party is not unlike the Know-Nothing Party that came about in the middle of the 19th century,
mm-hmm,
and always comes out in great periods of stress and transition. Now, the fact is that in this country, power is being taken away from the white male establishment, and that's been going on for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
When this country was formed, only white males who owned land could vote. And I say only white males because they were the only people that owned land. Women couldn't own property in many,
right,
states of the United States. And so what's happened to this country is that the power of white males to run the country and the economy has been broadened to the place they can't quite control it anymore. And the last election was devastating to that group of people because Mitt Romney,
yeah,
won the majority of the white male votes,
right,
but he lost big among women, he lost big among blacks, he lost big among Latinos, and lost big among people under 40. You know, only white males over 40. And that's not enough. And if we look at the demographics of this country, that vote is that's going to keep going in that direction. You know, the great fear of the right wing today is not only that they've got an African-American in the White House, but they've got a woman standing in the wings ready to be eight more years. That's devastating,
yeah,
for them.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's why you get gridlock in this country, and that's why you get this all this terrible political confrontation that never lasts, never gets anything accomplished. But anyway, I see this as the birth pangs of a new consciousness. I'm not worried about it. You can't buck consciousness. And what I think people need to recognize is that in every election, every 4 years when we elect a president, 8 years has gone by in terms of our voting blocks, because every 4 years, 4 years of people have died and 4 years of people have come of age. So in Obama's 8 years in the White House, you're going to have 16 years of a change in the voting body politic. And if Hillary is the president for the next 8 years, and that's highly speculative, she could be deceased by the time, you know. That's not good to speculate more than about a week in advance in politics. But that would mean 16 more years. That'd be 32 years. That means it's never going to be the same.
Yeah.
And when people see power slipping away, they're frantic. And part of the problem is that Christianity as an organized religion is in a fast free fall. The biggest movement in the church today is not the rise of fundamentalism. It's the rise of the secular society, the what I call the Church Alumni Association. They've gone out. And part of the problem for that is the church has not kept up with the times and has not engaged the issues that people are dealing with, so that when they come to church, they almost got to put their brains into a first century pretzel in order to understand worship, and they don't want to do that. So it's increasingly unpopular. When people like me and many others try to bring Christianity into the 21st century, the primary enemies we have are not the secular society. It's the right-wing religious who think we're violating everything about our religious background. I think that if you don't churn in that religious atmosphere and open up new possibilities, that there's no future in the Christian faith. I just don't believe that the idea that you're born in sin and that you're infected with original sin and that God has to rescue you, and the way God rescues you is to kill his son on the cross so that he can pay, presumably God, for your evil, makes any sense to anybody. And yet we've been saying Jesus died for my sins for so many years that people think that that must be the heart of the Christian faith. That's the atonement theology, and it's basically a gift of the fourth century. It's a gift of St. Augustine's, among other people. That's been a stream, but I think we're in a period where it's got to change. And we've gone through that before.
Yeah.
Now, Christianity was born in a Jewish world. All of our symbols were Jewish, and we had to translate them into a Gentile world. And Augustine is the guy that turned Christianity into being something that was in dialogue with Plato. And then Plato ran out, and Aquinas came along in the 13th century, and he turned Christianity to be in dialogue with Aristotelian thought. Then the Reformation came along, and the world was beginning to get all sorts of new ideas coming in from the East, and humanism was rising. And the Reformation was an attempt to turn Christianity to deal with this new reality. And that was the first time when we couldn't keep the whole body together. So we broke into a Protestant and a Catholic thing, which has never been healed. And what I think we're doing today is that the worldview of the 21st century is so far removed from the worldview of religion that they are thought to be mutually exclusive. If you can separate the Christ experience from the explanation of the Christ experience, then you have a chance to talk about that experience in a different language. But if you can't separate them, if you've decided that the Bible, which is a first century explanation of the Christ experience, or the creeds, which are a fourth century explanation of the Christ experience, or the most of the liturgies of the churches, which come out of the 13th century, if those things are essential to the experience, then there's no way you're going to keep the experience alive.
This is the moment to talk about your new book, Taking a Serious Look at the Fourth Gospel.
I'm in some sense prepared for this book for a long time, because other titles were things like Rescuing the Bible from Fundamentalism, which was to separate us from the stuff we usually grew up with. The Sins of Scripture was another one I wrote, where I took texts from the Bible that had been used to hurt people in all sorts of ways, to hurt women, to hurt black people, to hurt gay people, to justify war, and suggest that maybe that's not the right way to use the Bible. I talked about why Christianity must change or die to analyze the reasons why we can't just keep saying the same old words. I avoided the fourth gospel for most of my career because I really didn't like it. I didn't like it because it seemed to portray a Jesus that I couldn't relate to. He was a divine visitor. He was sort of God in disguise, and he didn't suffer. In the fourth gospel, there's no prayer in Gethsemane that says, "Father, let this cup pass from me." There's no cry, "My God, why have you forsaken me?" Because that was just considered something that Jesus couldn't do because he was so divine. It also fed the anti-Semitism that I'd spent a lifetime. And only in the fourth gospel does Jesus say things like, "The Jews are the children of the devil." That's a pretty harsh line. When John uses the phrase "the Jews," he means the enemies of the Jesus movement. He does not mean Jewish people as an ethnic group. And so I didn't find the book very exciting. And when I finally decided to study it, I discovered that the fourth gospel is basically a Jewish book. It's not a Greek book. It's not a Philo book. It's not an attempt to bind Athens with Jerusalem in some new homogenized form. It's deeply, deeply Jewish. But secondly, it's in conflict with itself, because the struggle in the early Johannine community was between the Jews of the Christian movement and the Jews of the Orthodox party. And when they were finally excommunicated, then they had to define Jesus outside Jewish terms. They didn't really go outside Jewish terms. They went outside Jewish religious terms and turned to, I believe, something that we would call Jewish mysticism today. So they began to talk about how God and Jesus were one. By the time you get to the 4th century and the Council of Nicaea, the only way they know how to make God and Jesus one is to have the God from above the sky come down and take on the flesh of a human being. But in Jewish mysticism, you become one in mystical union. If you read the 4th gospel from a mystical union perspective instead of an incarnation perspective, then most of its problems disappear for me. When Jesus is made to say, "The Father and I are one, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father," if Jesus is allowed to use the I Am name of God, which he does throughout that gospel, it's not about incarnation. That's a Greek idea. It's about mystical oneness. And the idea that it's expressed in the farewell discourse is that we've got to think of the vine as Jesus, and we are the branches of the vine, and the same life flows into us that keeps the vine alive, and that God is the caretaker of the vine. That's a whole different way to approach. And the final thing about the fourth gospel that impressed me was that he makes the crucifixion the climax. It's not the resurrection. The crucifixion is where God is revealed. "When I am lifted up, then I will draw all people to myself," he says. "Then you will know I am," is what the text really says. You will know the reality of God when I am lifted up. And so I saw in Jesus, in the fourth gospel, a portrait of a different kind of humanity, human to the core, but transcending the limits of survival and the boundaries under which we human beings live. And so the idea develops that that's the way you enter into the reality of God. If I want to be divine, it's not that divinity and humanity are two separate categories against each other. That's Greek dualistic thought. In the Johannine gospel, if you want to be divine, you become deeply and fully human, and you transcend the limits of your humanity. And the one place that I think people understand that and experience that is when they fall in love. And so I like to talk about falling in love. When you fall in love with somebody, you escape your own survival mentality. Suddenly you love somebody else more than you love yourself. Suddenly the well-being of the beloved is more important to you than your own well-being. And this is that momentary taste of a transcendent sort of life, a new kind of freedom, a new kind of consciousness. So I began to see the Jesus story as a call into a different dimension of humanity instead of a call into religion or into piety or into any of those things. And to me, that's just enormously freeing. Mm-hmm. John has Jesus say, "I am the bread of life." That's the holy name of God, I am. And Jesus never said that. I can't imagine Jesus saying that. In fact, if Jesus had wandered around saying, "Oh, by the way, I am the bread of life, and if you don't eat me, you won't have everlasting," I think it'd put him in a mental hospital. But I think the Christian community, and John's written well after the time of Jesus, almost 70 years, what the Christian community is saying is we find something in the life of Jesus that satisfies the deepest hunger for humanity and the soul, and so we call him the bread of life. We find in him the deepest sense of community and belonging, so we have him say, I am the vine and you and I are the branches. We find in him the source of life, so we hear him say, I am the resurrection and the life. We find in him a way into the deeper dimensions of God, and so we hear him saying, no one comes to the Father but by me. That doesn't mean by the Christian religion. There was no such thing as a Christian religion when he said that.
Right.
It's by the experience of humanity that draws us beyond our limits. So I found this gospel just really exciting and wonderful.
The Right Reverend Bishop John Shelby Spong, I told you when we started that it was an honor to interview you. It's also enlightening and inspirational. And I appreciate you as an unmitigated protagonist for authenticity and truth, and pray that your tribe increases. Thank you.
Thank you very much. My mother would probably agree with you.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share it with that person. Direct people to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. Look, the community that's grown around State of Belief Radio, it's a community we're proud of. It's active all week long online. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. Happy Labor Day weekend. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.